Welcome back for part two of my discussion with Professor Michael McConnell of Stanford Law School. You know, one of the things that's frustrating as a citizen, which we both are, no matter what we actually know in our fields of expertise, it seems to me that there's no accountability for simply breaking the law, but going against by people in power. And now here I'm just giving one example. I'm not saying it's one-sided, but the forgiving of the student loan issue. Where was the accountability once the Supreme Court, at least spirit, if not literal, decision was broken by the president? There was no accountability of this.
No, there
right?
really isn't any. I mean, a really interesting, great, clear case of this was President Obama gave subsidies to health insurance companies that Congress had specifically refused to appropriate money for. The House of Representatives sued in court. Whether they really could do that is a subject for another day, but they did, and they were allowed to. But by the time the district court said to President Obama, you can't do that, $7 billion had already gone out the door. That's spending $7 billion not appropriated by Congress. That's, I mean, if a corporation did that, I mean, they would be in jail.
Right. So that is a problem, I think, sort of in a generic sense, is there's a source of frustration I feel in a lot of people, including myself, that there's no accountability, despite claiming that we have such a check in power, we have such a strong Department of Justice, we have, and I'm not saying other countries have a better one. I'm just wondering, when we're in an era where the people in charge, the most prominent leaders of our government, simply defy the law, even when they are challenged and found incorrect, it's very sort of. Not just strange, but it's frightening. I mean, then you're really talking about a threat to democracy. You're talking about a constitutional crisis. You have a society that's sort of off the rails if you don't have an intact and valid Department of Justice.
Well, I think that's right. But, you know, the way we have operated is when presidents do something that is, let's say, constitutionally questionable, and every president does, you know, they all do things that may or may not be legal. It goes to court. And then when the courts say you can't do that, they stop doing it.
Right.
But that doesn't mean the people who did it are punished for it. They're not. It's like, don't do it anymore. And you proceed. And for the most part, you know, we've gone for, you know, 235 or some odd years on that system, and it has not been a constitutional crisis. I think what we've seen under Trump, but also to a somewhat lesser degree, but not a different, you know, same sort of thing, even if lesser degree, under the preceding presidents, is a more open defiance and Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes called this the bad man theory of law, that it does, you know, law only really, the only thing that's really law is when you tell the bad man he can't do what he's doing. But I think the U.S. Constitution has proceeded on a more of a good man theory of law. That is, the Constitution is, we just expect our leaders to respect the Constitution and to stay in their lanes and to respect, we expect presidents to respect the role of Congress and the courts. We expect the courts to, you know, not overreach with respect to the president. We expect all these actors to not just not to be bad men, but actually to be committed to making the system work as the way it's supposed
right.
to.
And upholding the
and
rule
in
of
this,
law.
You know, hyperpartisan atmosphere that we're in, I just don't think the respect is there. And we see President Trump saying things like, he's asked, does he have to follow due process? And he says, I don't know.
Yeah, I saw that interview. I'm not sure, Yeah, I don't know. I sort of feel like he was answering the question, do non-citizens have the same, quote, due process rights as citizens? But you're right. I saw the interview. I'm not clear what he was saying. And actually, that is
a more contentious area of law.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an essential part.
I think they are entitled to due process, but on the other side of that.
Yeah, let me ask it this way, as again a naively non-knowledge based question. You have somebody who's here illegally because the previous president apparently did not enforce legal immigration barriers. I'm making that judgment based on just simply layman knowledge of the news and what we've observed. But assuming that's true, and these people are indeed illegal immigrants, okay, let's make that assumption. Do they, what are the limits to what the president can do to expel them from the country, since they are by definition criminals who are here illegally? Why would, it seems sort of odd to me that somebody would be entitled to legal rights if they are already deemed here illegally. I mean, I think the practical point that Trump seems to raise frequently, and I think it's sort of obvious, you have million, let's just say there's 10 million roughly illegal people here. You couldn't possibly deport them if each one of them goes through the hearing process, the legal procedures, the filings, as you mentioned earlier in this discussion about how long things take. So how is that resolved? And not just simply an academic law part, which is part of it, of course, but also the practical sense.
So this is complicated, and I'm not an expert in immigration. The immigration laws are extremely complicated. I remember my head hurt when I first began to decide some immigration law cases as a judge. I'd never had to study this, and it's like impenetrable language. But here, basically, when people are trying to come across the border, they do not have due process rights to come in. So if you stop them at the border, and by the border, that means, you know, maybe not just the border, but a little bit in, you know, as they're coming in, they can be sent back if they don't have the right to be here. And
in other words, they don't get to demand a hearing. They don't get to demand anything.
That's right. So what has been happening, especially under President Biden, was that instead of telling them to go back, they were actually welcome. So people coming in unlawfully would actually intentionally report themselves to the officer, because they would then get paroled in to the country. That was our policy under the last administration. And
even though before you go on, that policy is contrary to law.
It's contrary to law, except, so I mean, with the qualification that resources are limited, they can't deal with everybody. And so it just like, For a policeman to sit on the side of the highway and see somebody going 67 miles per hour on, you know, in a 65 zone, yeah, the law says that person ought to get a ticket, but in reality, they're not. There's a certain amount of that going on, but the parole process, I think, was stretched beyond the limits of the law. There was also another detail. I don't know how much we want to be into the weeds of this, but under international law, people coming in have the right to make claims of asylum. That is, if you send me back, I'll be subject to persecution on the basis of, you know, various things. Well, if you make that claim, you may have zero evidence for it. It may be total BS, But you make the claim, and then you're entitled to a certain amount of process on your asylum claim. And so that was also used by the prior administration as a justification for paroling people. And then they would be told, come back. You come into the country, and then they're instructed to report back to a hearing 8 years later, 12 years later. I mean, and then we don't know where they are, and there's no enforcement of that. And so it was like it was a fiction. So basically at the border, we can send people back, but we haven't been doing it. Once people are in, and especially if they're in under some sort of, parole or other legal basis, at that point they do need process to revoke whatever status that they had. Now, having entered the country illegally, and now let's say you're in, St. Louis or wherever, and you're apprehended, you are not a criminal. That is, having entered, there is no law against an undocumented person, which is the way we lawyers like to talk about them. That's not a crime. If they were deported once and came back again, that's actually a crime, so they could be prosecuted. But just having come into the country illegally, you could not be prosecuted. You could not be sent to prison for that. But you are nonetheless still deportable.
You mean, in other words, once someone's
a criminal and being deportable,
right. Once someone is actually here, inside, that means implies or it is inferred from their existence inside that was sanctioned by the government.
Well, that's going a little too far. It's that you haven't committed a crime in the United States.
I see. Okay. The crime of entering illegally
is not you're not prosecuted for that. But you are still deportable.
And once they've been ordered to be deported, like some of these people, and maybe this is a very small number, I don't know, have had their hearings, apparently, and have been told they are deported. What about those people? Well, are those people?
Apparently, we don't always deport them, even when that's the case. And I think that's because of resource limitations. But then it may also be that some administrations are just not that interested in seeing that the law be enforced. I could have this wrong, but I believe that this person we've been hearing a great deal about, Obregon Garcia, was held deportable. And there's some dispute, but there's at least some reason to think that he was held, that he may have committed domestic violence and other actual crimes. And then what was held by the judge at the time was that he should be deported, but not back to El Salvador. He's a Salvadorian, not back there, because he was able to prove because of, I think, gang membership. I think it's like the Jets and the Sharks and West Side Story. If he went back, he would be likely
in danger.
And he would be in danger. And so they could send him anywhere other than Salvador. And if I understand what happened here correct, it just seems like Keystone Cops. If you believe what the Trump administration says, when they sent him to Salvador, it was just a mistake. But they didn't know about this order. And he was several hundred people were being sent to this apparently quite horrendous facility in
El Salvador.
And they didn't know that one of them, Garcia, had an order saying he couldn't be sent back to Salvador. And the lawyers admitted this in court. Well, I think the higher reaches of the administration may have tried to backtrack from that, but I still think it's the formal position that the United States took in court. And so that's why, I don't know how you feel about these
individuals.
I think yeah. if it was a mistake, you just bring him back. They shouldn't have had to wait for a court order to bring him back. They should have just brought him back. And then they can deport him again. They can deport him to anywhere else in the world under the deportation order that is already in place. They might even be able to deport him to Salvador by going back and saying that that danger that he was in 10 years ago is no longer there. But you have to go through some process.
Is it correct to
say, we acknowledge that we were wrong to send you there, but we're not going to do anything about it. It's not just a matter of law. It seems to me it's just a matter of that's not the way we operate. I mean, if I'm grading a student, if a student comes to me with a paper and says, oh, look, you added up the points on my exam wrong, I don't say, oh, well, okay, it was a mistake, but, you know, you're stuck. I'm not going to change it. I change it.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. Yeah, so now, let me ask, what about this idea of federal ICE agents, federal immigration enforcement agents, and the conflict, it seems, between the state and the federal government, even in simply allowing the federal government to, this whole idea of a person who's an illegal immigrant who's committed a crime in a state. There seems to be a lack, not just a lack of cooperation, it's much more than that. There's actually a direct conflict between enforcement of the law and the agencies trying to enforce laws on these same people. What is the obligation, if any, of a state legal body or a justice entity to work with the federal legal or Department of Justice?
So the states and local governments are not required to help the federal government enforce federal laws. This is, Supreme Court has held that. Originally in a case, by the way, involving gun control, where some sheriffs in Montana, the Congress passed a law that imposed on local law enforcement the obligation to administer the background checks for federal gun control laws. And some sheriffs in Montana said, we don't want to do that. You can't make us do that. And the Supreme Court said, you're right. Federal government does not have the power to force states and local governments to assist in the enforcement of federal law. Liberals, by the way, were outraged by that. Now they like it because this is what I love about constitutional law is it what's sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. You may not like it in one context, but then it's going to come and bite you in the butt in another. And so it's I like the fact that both sides get hit. But I do think that insofar as these sanctuary cities are doing nothing other than refusing to help the federal government, I think they're within their rights, but they can't obstruct the federal government in its own enforcement. And that, I think that's a pretty clear statement in the abstract, but how that cashes out in individual cases, there can be some really, it's sometimes very difficult to tell the difference between withholding help and actual obstruction. This judge that was arrested in Wisconsin apparently, in fact, I don't think there's any doubt what happened here is that the federal agents had said, we're going to arrest him as soon as you're finished with your proceeding, and we will do it out in a public area. We're not asking for your help. As soon as he gets back to the public area, we're going to arrest him, but we want to let you know that's what we're doing here. And instead of sending him back out into the public area, she called some people up and sneaked him out in a side door so that he wouldn't be where the federal agents would be able to arrest right. him.
I think was arrested. Yeah, that sounds far worse.
She's charged with obstruction of justice. Yeah.
And what do you think about that?
I actually think that's, I don't know the facts, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, I think that's probably right. Now, the only real interesting question is whether any of what she did was an official action as a judge. If these were actually actions in her official judicial capacity, there's at least a good argument that she would be entitled to immunity from federal prosecution for much on basically the same argument that President Trump was held to be immune as a president. But that's disputed. There actually is a case back in the 1880s called in Ex Parte Virginia, in which a state court judge was criminally prosecuted for not allowing black people to be on juries. So as the civil rights laws required, and this U.S. Supreme Court upheld the criminal prosecution of a state court judge for that. So this is an area of some, you know, is that still good law? Not quite sure. But that looks to me as though that's on the other side of the line.
That seems
the state would not have been, the judge would not have been required to send this person, you know, out. I mean, to right. actually help. So it's going to be a lot of, I think there are going to be lots of clear cases on both sides of this line. But
will this be the defense, though, for this judge? Will the defense be, or is the defense, I don't know, that she exercised her action as a judge? In other words, she you know, vis-a-vis what you said, which is basically she doesn't have to cooperate legally. Is that the defense, that she was acting as a judge to let him out?
I haven't seen, I assume she's filed something. I haven't read what their defense actually is, but I would guess that she would have two lines of defense. One is a line that any state or local official would have, which is, I'm not required to help the federal government. And so be, you know, which side of the line does this action fall on? But then I think she has an additional line of defense because of her judicial status. And you can see why it just isn't good to be prosecuting judges for their official acts. Like
official
that
acts.
Would mean that That's if right. you're sitting there as a judge and making a hard decision, you have to ask yourself, well, am I putting myself personally in danger? You want the judge to be making the judgment on the basis of
right. But this wasn't a judgment on the case.
No, it
wasn't.
Was
a judgment.
So I don't think so. You know, but it could be that there's some aspect of this that was actually, I'm not saying it is. I'm just saying I'm pretty confident that will be part of the defense.
I want to get to this.
And by the way, this is like, it's a similar problem with the president. I mean, when President Trump, you know, is on a phone call to Raffensperger in Georgia and tells him, this is disputed, and you know, you can care. I'm not judging the characterization of the particular action, but tells him, you know, find, you know, 11,000 some odd votes in Georgia. Was that an official action of the president, or was that a private action of a candidate for president? You know,
right.
Not an easy line to draw.
Right, because both of those arguments can hold. Even both can hold simultaneously, I would
sometimes
guess. Yeah. And I want to get to the topic of free speech, censorship, and you're not just an expert on it in your law career, really, and profession as a constitutional scholar, but also you have this unique position on Meta's Oversight Review Board, so you're a perfect person to have this discussion with.
Uh-oh.
And I think there's so many ways we can go, but first is, you know, and I've heard you say this, I'm not a lawyer, of course, and so I have a philosophy on this, and my personal philosophy is I would rather err on the side of more free speech than less free speech, but that has nothing to do with what the law is. And I sort of would like first to set me straight on, we don't have pure free speech. Of course, there are limits on speech. What are those limits? for people who are trying to understand why they can't say whatever they want.
So you're talking about over social media.
Well, over social media, or the implication of what's on social media by virtue of this whole called, oh, you can't shout fire in a movie theater kind of thing.
My view, and I think the Supreme Court sort of supported this in a recent decision, but these are private companies. They run these platforms, and they can censor people if they want to. I mean, it's just like if you have your, you know, this is a podcast, or I don't know what you call it, whatever we're on right
it's
now.
It's a podcast.
You invited me, but you didn't have to. And if I say something outrageous, or even if I say something extremely reasonable that you don't like, you can shut me down. You know, it's your...
Like what you just said.
it's your thing. Now, when the platforms get as huge as, you know, Meta and YouTube and Twitter and so forth, when they get that big, they have the appearance of, you know, becoming something a little bit different. And this is an argument, you know.
Like the new town square. Yeah. It's the public.
Years ago, I represented the Boy Scouts of America when their practice of not allowing gay scoutmasters was under challenge. And we took the position and we won, but only 5-4, that Boy Scouts is a private organization. They can choose their leaders however they want, however, you know, whatever you may think about their particular decision. But there was a lot of rhetoric at the time. It's like the Boy Scouts had become, because of its size and its place in American culture, it felt like it was a public institution. And I think that's behind a lot of this with companies like Facebook. But
what about news, like news networks? Are those public, even though they're private, like the New York Times? Or
New York Times is easy. Newspapers can do what they want. They have complete editorial discretion. Now, what about NBC, CBS, and so forth? I would have thought that they also enjoy freedom of the press. I would have thought that, except that the Congress in its wisdom imposed what they called, or at least authorized the FCC to impose what were called the Fairness Doctrine, which regulated the ability of stations, broadcast stations, radio and TV, and controlled their editorial discretion. And the U.S. Supreme Court, in the case in the 1960s called Red Lion Broadcasting, upheld that. Now, I teach that case. I love teaching that case. I think that case was wrongly decided.
But what does the case hold again?
Broadcast TV and radio, that the government can interfere with editorial discretion in favor of what it calls fairness, that is having to give equal time to both sides.
Equal time.
And there are other aspects as well as the equal time requirements, but that's, you know, part.
So this is why they say we invited so-and-so to appear, but they declined.
Well, they might do that because of journalistic ethics rather than just...
Yeah. I find the journalistic ethics,
which can do whatever it wants, will say we try to interview them and they decline to comment. That's important information for readers to know that they try. But yeah, there's a legal backdrop to all this. Now, the Fairness Doctrine was scrapped as a political decision under the Reagan administration, so we no longer have it. So it's not legal,
see.
We don't have any cases anymore, but Red Lion has at least never been overruled. And some people say, well, Red Lion was right, and the social media companies are more like broadcast stations than they are like newspapers. And so the government should be able to regulate this. This is the basis. Texas and Florida passed these laws would have subjected this social media companies to a kind of equivalent of a fairness doctrine. Mm-hmm. Supreme Court, in a rather confused and not really straightforward decision, said, no, they can't do that. But that's not entirely settled. And Justice Clarence Thomas thinks that the social media companies are, in effect, public utilities, that they're like, the electric company and have to serve everybody equally. It's a respectable position, even if it isn't one that I share. So that's the law side of it. But as to, what the oversight board does, we are not law at all. We have nothing to do with.
Yeah. What is the Meta Oversight Review Board?
So it's a voluntary creation of this one company because Mark Zuckerberg got tired of being the decision maker. Like, you have all these extremely complicated, is it good to have speech about this? Is it dangerous to have speech about that? And the First Amendment is not the same, doesn't cover it. I mean, just as an easy example, the First Amendment would not allow the government to say what you're saying is spam. It couldn't cut out spam and throw people in jail for uttering stuff that's if social media companies didn't exclude spam, we'd all just go crazy. I mean, it would make it impossible. So they exclude spam. One of Facebook's early decisions was that they wouldn't have adult nudity, with some very narrow exceptions. Well, First Amendment wouldn't allow a government to do that. So the First Amendment is not answering these questions. Mm-hmm. Well, Facebook is not. People, I think, imagine that they want to be the world censor. They want to make money. That's what they want. And Zuckerberg himself is really an engineer. He wants to make new products. He is not that keen on having to make decisions that are lose-lose. Somebody's going to be mad at everything. So he reached the judgment, why don't we create this body of people who have some expertise about this, thinking about free speech questions, and let them, we'll outsource the final decision on the hardest, the most contentious of these questions to this outside body, and we'll do what they say. They didn't have to do that, but they did do that. And so that's, we are basically, the oversight board is basically Meta's creation to have this happen. Now, it's in their interest because it gets this, hot potato, out of Zuckerberg's lap.
Yeah, onto somebody else. It's a shift of responsibility.
Actually, I think it's in the public interest too, mm-hmm. because this is a fair, nobody's balanced, but it's a pretty representative, diverse group. 22 people from all over the world, very distinguished. I mean, myself may be excluded, but very distinguished people with relevant expertise. And I actually think the public should be very pleased that this kind of a body exists, but it has nothing to do with free speech under, the First Amendment.
The First Amendment, right. It's a separate issue. But I would say something. Yes, I understand everything you're saying, and intellectually and even legally. On the other hand, during COVID, I was advisor to the president. I said the data in a tweet, for instance, about masks, literally giving the data. And I was not only blocked, it was taken down and my account was suspended as the advisor to the president. And then when I talked about that in the White House, by the way, people were sort of laughing and saying, yeah, well, they also blocked the president himself. No, which I think these are examples where I don't see how that's in the public good in a free society, or even intended to make money, quote unquote. Like you said, yes, it's a business. We would think that businesses want to make bottom line, but I'm not sure how that serves the public to make them not hear what the advisor to the president was saying during an emergency, or not hear the president himself. And I'm not sure that's, at least in my gut feeling, and I'm biased because I was an object of that decision, I'm not sure how that's justifiable, let alone reasonable.
So I don't defend that a bit. I think what was done to you, and you're not alone. I mean, there were a number of other experts who were being excluded, and then you heard.
Well, my position was very.
You also had these fact checkers who are, you know, like undergraduate degree holders who are telling PhD experts that that they were wrong, and this was a terrible time, and the company. I mean, Zuckerberg himself has admitted that this was bad. Not that it does you any good retrospectively, but he has it.
By the way, I just want to interrupt and say, I'm not talking about a specific company either. That was just an example, but I'm saying the issue to me
wasn't just Facebook. It was most of them.
Yeah, I know. Right. Exactly. But I guess the issue to me is it's one thing to say, even in a sort of almost character assassination way, that certain people, whether experts or not, are wrong and whatever you want to say about that. It's a different level to shut the public out from hearing what the advisor to the president is saying to the president. I don't see, and I think it's not, and also then the president himself was kicked off of some of these social media companies. I'm not sure how that, I don't know if it's First Amendment, it's a private company, right? But somehow that seems really bad policy. But I don't know if there's a legal question there or not. And that's sort of what I'm asking.
So I don't think so. Confining to the COVID context rather than, I mean, Trump was excluded on a sort of because of the January 6th business, and it raises.
Yeah, but this is before that.
A different set of questions. You know, I like to think that if the oversight board had been asked to decide, if you had appealed, I think you were before the. I think your instance was before the.
This is fall board. Of 2020.
Now, this is before the board actually existed. So the only time the board actually had anything to do with this was we did a retrospective review of the of how the company behaved under COVID, and we were quite critical. The one thing I would say kind of on their defense is this, that so you were a political advisor to the president, but the company was listening to the Centers for Disease Control and the people like and they are not people like Zuckerberg will tell you, you know, they're not experts on any of this. People are dying. It's like, you know, who's going to it's a hugely consequential decision whichever way you go. You know, maybe yeah. We should cut the company a little slack when they were following the advice of these official bodies. Now, one thing, I mean, let me tell you two things that the board criticized retrospectively when we issued this report on the COVID period is that one thing is we think it's really bad when government officials call social media companies and tell them you should take down. I mean, and I think you were mentioned by name, and you weren't the only one. I think our colleagues.
Right. This was secondary in 2021,
and not just COVID, but other issues as well. The government would actually call the companies and tell them what they wanted taken down, and I actually, if you read the record in the case, which is about this, which is called the Murthy case, the the factual findings are chilling about how much the government told the companies. And it was surprising to me that how much the companies actually resisted. And in one case, like the number two person at Meta actually calls the White House and said, no, we can't take this down. Our rules, you know, this is in compliance with our rules. We can't do it. And the, and what did the White House do? They said, take it down anyway. And that was the day that President Biden went on the news and told, said that Meta had was guilty of, like, I forget the exact quote, but something like murdering a million people. I don't think he used the word murder, but responsible for the deaths of a million people. And the administration said, and we're going to look into antitrust investigations of the company. And lo and behold, the company folded.
Now, isn't that...
And so we...
I would think that's illegal.
I think this is terrible. I mean, I think this is similar to some of the things President Trump is doing now, but it was done then and more and very systematically. And what we said was that the companies should adopt a policy of any time the government tells them to take something down, that they make that public. So that it there
now, that's
needs
a good
to
idea.
Be accountable for that. I think that's a great idea. And they've sort of halfway agreed to that, but I'd love to see them fully embrace that, and not just in the United States. Other parts of the world are, if anything, worse on the
right. Now, we see it in the UK now.
Absolutely.
Really...
Actually, the first time we made that recommendation had to do with the London Metropolitan Police, who had told the companies to take down a kind of music video that they thought was encouraging gang violence. So anyway, so that was one thing. And then a related point, what we also made is that in looking forward into the future, that they should be less reliant upon these single authoritative governmental sources, but should open, when they're considering issues of scientific and historical and other truth, when they're, you know, that they need to hear from a wider range of voices, because sometimes the government is captured by a particular faction, and it's certain
not just sometimes.
Sometimes COVID was. I think we all learned a lot about COVID and how and what it does, what it did, and.
As an issue, it exposed so many things.
I hope we just take away a lot of good lessons from it, because it was so many things were done that should not have been done.
I want to finish up with a small amount of time on the Supreme Court itself. You know, we hear a lot about Congress wanting to have ethics oversight. It seems to be. Again, I don't know if it's a change, but it seems more politicized in terms of the reputation of the court, the criticism of the court, and maybe I'm wrong historically. And then the remedies are always, we're going to, quote, pack the court, meaning, I think, increasing the number of justices. But then there's this accusation, oh, this president has packed the court simply because he nominated the people he wanted. What is happening in a sort of a broad sense? Is this a different era about the Supreme Court? Has this always been very contentious? And secondly, what is the future? Will there be changes, do you think, in the number of justices, et cetera?
Lots of questions there. Historically, there have been three or four times in American history where the composition of the Supreme Court has become a headline political issue, you know, where presidential candidates and so forth debate and so forth. And then it becomes calmer for a period. And we're in one of those periods where the court is much criticized. But you may note that that criticism is actually quieted down since President Trump's second term, because you know, when you have a Democratic president and the court is countering that, because the checks and balances go against both sides, that the left was very upset at the court. And I think they were actively undermining the legitimacy of the court. They were deliberately trying to do that. Well, now the court's function is checking this president. And I think the interest in undermining their legitimacy has pretty much withered away. Now, if they started upholding most of what Trump is doing, we'll probably get that criticism back again. But as long as the court is in its current posture of checking at least a lot of it, we just hear a little bit less. Mm-hmm. Now, you ask specifically about court packing. I was the first witness at the Biden's commission on Supreme Court reform back a few years ago, and denounced the idea of adding justices. If that happens, the court becomes a complete political football. And if the problem today is that the court is maybe a little too political and not legal enough, well, I don't think the solution is making it 100% political. That seems like a bad idea. Now, the criticisms of the current court are partly based upon a historical accident, because going way back in my entire adult life, we've had alternating Republican and Democratic presidents. And they, other than when, Carter lost his second term, and then you had three terms of Republicans in a row, other than that instance, every president nominated and put two justices on the court. That's not in the law. It just happened that way. And when that happens, you have a kind of balance. That's the reason the court is so closely divided, is because we shift parties for the nominating individual. Well, President Trump, in just one four-year term, nominated three justices, whereas in the past, in an eight-year term, they were nominating two. This was a historical accident in part, but it was also the product of political hardball on the part of Mitch McConnell, no relation, by the way, Mitch McConnell and the Republican Senate, when they declined to entertain the nomination of Merrick Garland after Justice Scalia's death. And it was political hardball, but I'm persuaded, and some major Democrats have confirmed this, that they'd have done the same thing if the shoe was on the other foot. This is a pretty obvious act of political hardball, but it was political hardball that that led to this phenomenon where Trump got more nominations.
That knocks your vacancy, basically.
That's right. Yeah. That's why people claim that there's an unfairness.
On the human nature side of things, and I don't know if this is just obviously an opinion, but the Supreme Court is in the news a lot, in the opinionated news a lot, whether it's news or not, but anywhere commentary. And I wonder if this has an impact on the justices. I mean, they have lifetime appointments. So in that sense, okay, realistically, they really aren't subject to the whims of the political day, but they're human beings. There are potential assassination attempts. Their character assassination is common now in the media. I wonder if you could have any insight into, does this have an impact? I would guess not consciously, but of course they're human beings.
So this is a world I kind of live in, so maybe I can. I think it depends on people. There are some individual justices who are extremely thick-skinned and independent, and I don't think it's influencing them.
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, those who went through what they regarded as, you know, highly, you know, character assassination style nomination struggles, like Clarence Thomas, I think he will never be willing. He just does. I mean, I think that inoculated him against any idea that maybe the world of you know, elite opinion on the Supreme Court has any fairness at all. But there is, I think, a lot of belief that many judges, maybe whether it's Supreme Court justices, it's hard to tell, but you do live in this world where if you decide things the way the left and moderate left want, you get invitations to give lectures at law schools, and you get fawn, you go there and you have, you know, the students treat you like a hero. Remember Ruth Bader Ginsburg was treated like a total hero, whereas Clarence Thomas isn't even mentioned in the Museum of African American History in the Smithsonian.
Mm-hmm.
This was dubbed by somebody, I don't remember who came up with this, but the greenhouse effect, because Linda Greenhouse was the Supreme Court reporter for the New York Times for many years. And so the greenhouse effect was that judges tend to sort of move to the left, or at least moderate left, because of the influence of newspapers, and not just newspapers, you know, cocktail parties. So, you know, most of the justices go off. I remember one of them would go off every summer to Gstaad and meet with a lot of Europeans and whenever you do something that they like, you're treated like a hero. And when you do something that they don't like, you're treated like a rat. And that's, it would be only human to be affected by
yes.
that.
Mm-hmm.
If you look over time, there have been a number of people who appeared to be conservatives when they were appointed to the Supreme Court and moved to the left over the course of their lengthy careers on the court.
Yeah, that's my impression.
I don't think there's a single example. Maybe Byron White, but I don't think he really is an example of somebody who was appointed looked like he was of the left and moved right.
Right. The swing vote, the way I look at it, the swing vote always seems to be a Republican appointee who is the moderate center and goes either way. But you don't, again, I haven't studied it, but it sure seems like the leftist type appointments, they're never a swing vote. We know where they're going to be. And maybe that's an over, is that, you think that that's a generally true statement?
I think it's generally, I don't think it's always true. I think there have been some times when Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer in particular have been, you know, have departed from the party line, but it's usually true. Mm-hmm. And even in cases where it seems a little odd, so that the conservatives divide not just over how the case should come out, but they often write separate opinions because they have different ways of thinking about it, even if they come to the same conclusion. And some of these opinions are really quite feisty, and, you know, they go at each mm-hmm. other. There is just no sense that the conservatives on the court are like on a team. Well, there have been cases. I mean, I think, for example, of the Obergefell case, the same-sex marriage case, which, whatever you think of the outcome, the opinion was a mess, but not a single one of the liberal justices who joined in that wrote a separate opinion saying, well, I agree with this, but, you know, how about if we offer them, you know, a more coherent explanation for why? It was like a lockstep. And I think mm-hmm. It's an interesting difference between the left and the right on the court today. I'm guessing that is not an inherent thing about left and right. I think that's probably contingent on our current circumstances, but I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, they are, like I say, they're human beings, and sometimes we forget about that, including our politicians. Good or bad, they're human beings. So, all right, I think I'll stop intruding on your day, and thank you again for taking the time. There's so many things to talk about. I hope I can have you back.
Well, thank you, Scott. It was enjoyable.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to Independent Truths with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Stanford Law Professor Michael McConnell, check out his writings and interviews in the media, and particularly on his Stanford Law website. And don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube, as well as Spotify, Apple, Google, and anywhere else you're listening to podcasts today. And I'll see you next time.